Okay, sorry about the delay. Things happen. I hope this is up. This is up. So it did occur to me that we are pretty much at the end of the semester here. How many classes left apart from today's? Two, but it's really one. Okay, so we have two classes left, and one of them is a review class. And let me say a few things about the review class. I will spend maybe 15 minutes max on the course. After that, it's your turn. Ask me questions. Anything related to the course, of course. But any kind of questions go. And any problems, anything you want clarified, anything. So the rest of the class, I'll answer questions. I will not come with a lecture prepared. That's next week. So use your time wisely. If everybody runs out of questions, I've been doing this for a long time. So generally, people keep going till the end of the class. But if you don't, we'll leave early. Okay, so that's for the last class, which is on Tuesday. I did put a posting on the thing, on that Google group saying download anything you want to. The server has a bad habit of going down during exams or just before exams and things like that. And that's when everybody wants to access it. And it's not available. So do it now. Okay? That way you have... And if something goes wrong, it'll get fixed between now and whenever. But, yeah. It's two parts. Two parts means it's one exam. So it's really a little more than about 2 hour exam, so it'll be 1 hour each. Essentially, it helps us get the grades in time. A 2 hour exam on Thursday cannot be graded by Saturday or Sunday. So that's just not possible. So that's why we do this. Okay. So please come prepared with questions and all that. So there's not a whole lot of time left. So there's today's class and the next class.
Did you switch the source over from computer to laptop? I want to make sure that's working.
This is muted. Even the computer is not muted.
Laptop?
No, it's VGA. But what about the computer? The computer is on.
And you've hooked up your...
Yeah, I did. The document camera that.
Just make sure that. Yeah, I think that did it. So now you have this.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay, I didn't even notice that whatever I wrote didn't show up. Thank you. So where was I? Okay, so what are we going to do for the next two classes? I'm going to talk about I/O systems, and there's a few other topics that I'll get into next class. But right now, we have already talked about starting with disks, we want to be able to do files and directories. Somebody came up with that idea, it stuck. It was invented long, long time ago that secondary storage, which is long-term storage, people need to have the concept of files, which is a container for data. You must be able to name these files. You must be able to organize them in some tree-structured order, which is the directory system. But We are playing with disks. Disks are block-oriented devices, and block-oriented devices as opposed to... most devices are block-oriented. The two major examples are disks and network. We don't talk about network blocks, we just talk about network packets. Same thing, it's a block. And networks don't have sequence numbers, but it does to an extent. And so the disk is a sequence of blocks. It's permanently stored there until overwritten or failure happens. And from this block-oriented device, which has permanent storage, and whether it's, at this point, it doesn't matter whether it's a hard drive spinning or it's an SSD, which is all electronic. They both look exactly the same, except varying speeds, to the operating system, to the software. Okay? So we've got a sequence of blocks on this device. How do we transition the gap between just a sequence of blocks to this nicely structured file system? And that's what a file system's about. It can get very complex, but we'll keep it simple. But if you're told, start from scratch. Take this bunch of blocks and figure out a method to create structures in them. With a bit of thought, you'll come up with a particular way of doing things. So that means we can have hundreds and thousands of designs of these things, but we have to choose one for a particular system. So, people have converged on a few. There were several proprietary. The older one is the Unix file system. And then there's the Windows file system. And the notable one, Windows has several, NTFS is the... And they are kind of similar. The Unix file system I will not get into the NTFS structure. I'll talk about the Unix structure. It's simpler. But you can see the similarity. There's a bunch of things called metadata in NTFS, index nodes in Unix. They're the same thing. The structure in those things that consist of little structures, those are not exactly the same. They're organized differently. But conceptually, there's something called a master file table in NTFS, which has two copies. In Unix, we don't have a master file table. We put everything in the index block. And the partition table is the same. It's standard for all systems. That shows you the disk partitions. They're compatible. That way, you can put Unix file systems and NT file systems on the same disk. And so the idea is that I need... I'm going to store files. Files is several units of sequential bytes of data. To do this, I need to know where files start, where files end, what are the names of these files, and so on. So this contains the actual data is all the data in the files. to support this, I need to keep information about this. So metadata is data about data. And that has to be part of a file system somewhere. It has to be on disk. You don't want to lose your metadata. And although directories are metadata, but it's also considered a little different. This is which builds the structure out of the naming trees. That is, this folder or directory contains these folders or directories, and that structure is made. All I need is a format to put all this together. That format can be designed in hundreds, if not thousands, of different ways. There is no particular method which says this is the best way of doing this. It's an engineering design. So different operating systems, different versions have chosen all kinds of things. And I want to keep to the basics, which is I want files and directories. I am not getting into the more complex file systems. That's a course by itself. What about log structured file systems? What about journaling file systems? What are those things? Those things are added features on top of the basic file system, which gives you some benefits. It has some amount of crash recovery, some amount of speed up, fancier features. So let's not go there. To present this, so how is this done? There's a certain amount of disk storage as part of the formatting process that is reserved for this index area. The index area shall only contain a certain number of fixed-sized data structures or structs, which are called inodes. The size of an inode is fixed at, 14 entries, I think. We'll come to that in a minute. So the size of an inode is a certain number of bytes. We'll just calculate it very soon. And since if I reserve this part, it can only contain so many inodes. What is this inode for? Each inode, okay. Each inode is composed of 13 integers, nothing else. Each inode Okay, this doesn't say much, but we have to... Each inode represents one file. Each inode points to a file. A file is, its identity is an inode. And the inode contains 13 integers. It does not contain file attributes. It does not contain the file name. It does not contain whether the file is read or write protected. It does not contain who owns the file, when was it created. None of this is here. It's a very bare-bones system which says 13 integers will represent a file in its entirety. Okay? So from there, we jump to this is the index area, which is the fixed size. So since inodes are fixed size blocks, fixed size units of data, each inode is packed one after the other. The first one is inode 0, second one is inode 1, third one is inode 2. And these 0, 1, 2 is called an I number. So down in the Unix system, a file is identified by its I number. There's no naming, which will come later. So every file has a unique I number because it's represented. So how many inodes are there? How much did you reserve? Divided by 13. How many words did you reserve divided by 13? And that's the maximum number of files you can have on the disk. So you can run out of disk in two ways. One is you filled up your data area because they are very large files, or you have too many files and you filled up your index area. Both will give you an out of disk error. But the second one is not common. Most files are big enough that it fills up the data area before it fills up the inode area. So how does each inode represent a file? So how can we represent a file? A file is a set of blocks scattered in the disk area. Why scattered? Wherever you could find free space, you put blocks of the file there. And a file is an integral number of blocks. Files have sizes, but you could have a 3-byte file, but that's kind of a lie. A file is a minimum of one block, but if you've got 3-byte in that file, when you read it, you'll be told there's only 3 bytes here, and there's something like an end of file at the end of it, and the rest of the block is reserved, but there's nothing there. So let's say we have 3 blocks of a file. They can be scattered anywhere. How do you know that a file has these 3 blocks? Its addresses have to be stored somewhere. So one obvious way of doing it is that you store a pointer to the first block, and the first block has a pointer to the second block, and the file is a linked list of blocks. But this is not how file systems are done. This could be done. This has certain problems. If there's some corruption here, this link will be lost. If you want to quickly go to the 10th block of the file, you cannot. You have to read every block to get to the 10th block. You have to do sequential accesses only. Thirdly, the block of the file contains less than a block of the data because there's a bit of a pointer in there that causes mismatches with programming. We don't want it. We want the whole block to contain data. So the technique used by Unix, which is pretty much the same technique used everywhere, is this inode. So the inode contains 10 pointers pointing to the first 10 blocks of the file. Okay? But that's not enough. But there'll be 10 pointers pointing to the first 10 blocks of the file. So if you can find the inode, you can find 10 blocks of the file. The 11th entry, remember I said there are 13 entries. 11, 12, 13. Yeah, there are 13 entries. So here's the 11th entry. This is a pointer to an indirect block An indirect block, let's say if it's a 1 kilobyte file, it'll have 128 pointers. The pointers are integer sized. So, depending upon what your block size is, there's a certain number of pointer space allocated there, and it can have pointers to so many blocks of the file. So, the pointer in the inode points to an indirect block. The indirect block has up to 128 pointers to the next 128 blocks of the file. That may not be enough either. Then comes the 12th block, which contains a pointer to an indirect block, which contains pointers to another indirect block, and this contains file blocks. And this again is a pointer. So now I cannot draw this anymore. So there'll be 128 pointers there, pointing to up to 128 indirect blocks, each indirect block pointing to 128 bytes of the file. 128 blocks of the file. I'm assuming 1 kilobyte as the block size. Actually, in current systems, it's larger. But assuming 1 kilobyte block sizes, what's the size of the file that I can do with 12 entries in the inode? We have 128 times 128 blocks plus 128 blocks, plus 10 blocks, irrelevant. How much is 128 times 128? Anybody on the phone? 16,000. So 1 kilobyte, so 16,000 kilobytes, so 16 meg. So file size can be up to 16 meg. So that may be a little small. We add a 13th one, which is triple indirect.
128 cubed.
Pardon?
Would it be 128
cubed? which will be 16,000 times another 100. That's in the gigabyte range. 2 gigabyte. Now, 2 gigabyte plus some smattering of other things is the maximum file size on an old Unix system. These parameters are easy to change and have been changed. So files can be terabytes long. But when this was invented, there were hardly any hard drives above 100 megabytes. So saying there's a 2 gigabyte limit on file size was completely irrelevant. This is over-design, but that's how it was done for future growth, etc. So this can, we can use this today, but today, just increase the number of things and number of block sizes and you're done. So now we have one line. Now why come up with this harebrained scheme? Why not make everything triple indirect?
Do you need that much space?
No, we don't. But maybe we can have only one pointer to a triple indirect link. An inode becomes one byte, one integer. Sure, that could be done. That's the difference between a clean design, which is one pointer, that's all we need. That points to a triple indirect, to this hodgepodge, which is more optimized for performance. That is, two things. There's a lot of files that are rather small. They would use 10 direct links, 10K, enough. Some files are 11K, 12K, it'll use the second indirect link. So that means it'll have one extra thing dangling off of the inode, at most. Most files will have just one indirect block. So that saves space. Secondly, you access files sequentially from the beginning. So you're going to get to the first 10 blocks of the file by just reading the inode, which can be cached. And so without going to actual reading of the disk, the inodes are cached in memory. You can directly go to the file contents. And then if you cache this guy too, you can very quickly get to the file. But if you're getting into double indirects, then it'll get slower. And okay, so your larger file accesses will be slower, no biggie. Okay? So it speeds up the common case at the expense of the outliers, which are these huge files. And that's kind of a cute design. But at least we can see that if I can locate the inode of a file, I can get to the entire contents of the file. Okay. Now, I should have said something. I initially said that the inode does not contain anything about the file other than these 13 pointers. That's not true. I just wanted to simplify it. It contains a certain set of file attributes, but it doesn't contain the name of the file. It contains owner, permissions, date of creation, and maybe one or two things, a small bit of information about the file, the size. Maybe one or two things more. So that's also a fixed amount of information. So now we are up to 15 bytes. Make it 16 integers. 16 integers would be like 32 bytes. No, 64 bytes. That'll be the size of an inode. So whatever is the size of an inode, we know it's fixed. So if I, the operating system, if some application program says, I want to access a file with an I number 293, can I find the inode? I can. I count blocks from the beginning of the disk area, partition area, and I go so many bytes deep. I want 293 times size of inode, and that's my starting point. Zero times size of inode is the zeroth one. And now that I found the inode, I can find the entire contents of the file. Okay? So that means to access a file, you need an I number. I number is the name of the file. We humans don't like it. No, your files are not 3, 19, and 33. It's whatever the names are. So we need a translation mechanism from human-given names to I numbers. And that's what a directory is. So the starting point is so hard-coded into the file structure is something that's called the root directory. The root directory's name is not root. It has no name. It is written as slash. Okay? Slash is not a valid name. No file name can have a slash in it. So it's just a way of saying, I'm starting at the root. And it has no name. It has an I number of zero. Okay? So it's root directory is slash, I number is zero, and it contains a table. And this table has a fixed format. It's a fixed format, simplified, it contains a name. And that name field is variable size, but it has a limit on how big the name can be. After that, it'll truncate, maybe like 500 characters or something like that, so that you don't run into it. And it has an I number in it. It's a fixed format table. Now, if the root directory contains, what does the root directory typically contain? Anybody know?
Library?
Pardon? Yeah, but the names, it'll be like boot,
bin.
USR, yeah, bin. So this will be and whatever I numbers it contains. And those things can be files or can be directories. And if they're directories, it contains another directory table. If they're files, it contains an I number of a file. We're done. To that table. Now, even zooming out to a bigger picture, Let's say my root directory contains, this is at 0, this is at some, and there are three numbers in there. Probably if it was created in that order, F1 will have an I number 1, this will be I number 2, this will be I number 3. And I nodes are reused if a file is deleted, so you must have a deleted I list kind of thing over there. Now that we have this, if you notice, the I node is a pointer to the file, but it doesn't contain the name. The directory contains the name. So the way to think about a Unix file system is this is not F1, this link is F1. This is D1, this is D2. The links have names. And this can have some X1, X2. The links will have X1, X2. And you can pretty much create a link from here to here and call it Y1. So, /D1/Y1 is the same file as /X1. And these are called hard links. A file can have multiple names because the file doesn't have a name. The links, the path has a name, and you can get to a file through multiple paths. And if you want to set up links inside your directory, you use the command ln. That'll set up links.
Is that like a shortcut?
It's not a shortcut. It's not a shortcut. Why? A shortcut in Unix is called a symbolic link. Okay, I didn't write the name of this. I could have a shortcut to this file, or I could have two links to this file. These two links are equivalent. What happens if I delete this file? The difference shows up in the case of hard links. I cannot delete this file. I can delete a path to the file. So if I delete this, delete Y, delete F1 is not the name, F1 is the link. ABC, XY, F1. So if I delete XY, F1, that path, this link will get deleted. ABC will still be there. Whereas, if I delete the shortcut, only the shortcut will go away, the file will be there. But if this had only one link, if I delete the file finally, the shortcut will be left dangling. You'll still have that shortcut, which is say the file doesn't exist. But with a link, the file will always exist. Otherwise, the link will be gone. So this is a rewriting rule, that this name of this shortcut should be rewritten to the full path name and then traversed. Symbolic links and shortcuts are the same thing. It's for the convenience, whereas a hard link is embedded into the file system. And the rules say you create a link to the file by creating the file. That's your first link. You can add a link to an existing file. That's your second link. After you add your second link, the first link and second link are both links. They're equal stature. It's not like this link is first, that link is second. However, if you have a second or third or fourth link to a file, the file cannot be a directory. Why? The reason being, that's an overkill rule, that it ensures that you'll never have cycles in your directory tree. If you could link to a directory, then you would have to check, does that directory link back to this directory, creating a cycle? Or there could be several levels deep. We want to play games, and if you have a cycle in that thing, you cannot never delete it. It becomes a mess. So how do we make sure there's no cycles? If I allowed linking to directories, I'd have to check for a cycle every time we linked. Too much work. This is an easier way out, but much more restrictive. You will not link to directories. That's it. Because a file only gets deleted only if all of its links get deleted. So deleting a link to a file doesn't delete the file. It'll delete the file only if that was the only link to the file. Then the file contents get garbage collected. And if you have a cycle, that even if you delete a pointer to that cycle will still exist, just not reachable. So it's a mess. And you don't want all that in stable or secondary storage. A cycle in a memory doesn't matter. When the program dies, everything will be thrown away. But that's not the case with disks. Not terribly important at this point, but I thought I'd mention mounting. Mounting is a method. If you have two disks or two partitions on your Unix system, you will have two completely separate file trees. and accessing them becomes a problem. On your Windows system, if you have two disks, they'll show up as C and D. In the Unix system, there's no multiple trees, but yes, there is. It's kind of strange story. But if you have multiple trees in your Unix system, the primary tree is the one that you traverse. The secondary tree is not going to be visible. To make it visible, you have to mount it. So typically, you mount at the root, but you don't have to. You can mount any point in this tree over here and make this guy appear here. And if you want the whole tree to be visible, you mount the root to here. How do you do that? It is done through there's a table, a global table in the operating system called the mount table, and there you put an entry, it's the mount command, which will put two names there. A name of the tree on disk one, which will be replaced by the tree on disk two, and that link will appear. And it's also a symbolic link, it's not a hard link. Okay? Yeah. It is, A, B is on disk 1. B is a directory on disk 1. So that's the source that jumps to the jumps to the destination. So the source and the destination is really the same thing, but the destination is where it's stored, and the source has no storage for that part. So you go from source to destination, essentially. Okay, so that's a quick overview of how disks are organized in Unix. Very similar concepts exist in other systems like NTFS or EXT, which is the current Unix system. Okay? Yeah?
You said we can't see disk 2, right?
You cannot see disk 2.
How do we know?
There is a thing that you can do when you're dealing with mount tables where you put the disk 2's name, you have to name them, and you put the disk 2's name and colon. But that is not a legal file name under the file naming scheme. So it is allowed to use various disk names in a mount table, but not in your file name. It's just crazy rules. So file names always have to be slash something, something, something. Actually, it's not 4-bit. It's a little higher than 4-bit, but anyway. Let's do three bits only. There's a directory bit, there's a SUID bit, there is a something else bit. I don't remember. But these three bits are important. The three sets of permissions. The first set is for owner. That is, when a file is being accessed, we know who owns the file. Who owns the file? Whoever created it. And whoever created the file is the owner. Who's accessing it? If the owner is accessing it, then these bits count. If the somebody belonging to the owner's group is accessing it, these bits count. For everybody else, these bits count. This is a setup because once upon a time, Unix, which is the forerunner of Linux, was a multi-user system. Today's Linux is also a multi-user system, but we tend not to use it unless we log on to a Unix server where you log in with yours only. So most of the time, if you're using Linux, you will be looking at the owner bits. So in the owner bits, you can set it to readable. You can set no reading. No reading by owner. That's possible. You can set it to writable or not writable. You can turn the write permissions on off. You can set it to executable or not executable. Executables are only for binary code. If you set a text file to executable, it just creates a mess. But that's just because you can give somebody else execute privileges to your program but not give it read or write privileges. That means they cannot copy that program, they can run it. Okay? And then there's the SUID bit and the directory bit, which is not part of permissions, that says this is a directory, not a file, so we will not allow read-write to this directory. It has to be used through insert a link, delete a link kind of thing. So I'll talk a little bit about the system calls that I use from the application level. There are certain system calls which will allow you to access files that is stored on the disk. But the command chain is that if you use a system call, it'll go into the operating system first, which will be the demultiplexer. It'll decide this pertains to the file stuff, not other stuff. It'll send it to the file system. The file system will find the file you want to play with, check its permissions, check to see if you have access to it, and then do what you asked it to do, like read me a block, write me a block. If it involves actually physically reading or writing, it'll call the device driver to take care of it. But by then, it has figured out which block you're trying to read or write, because the device drivers know nothing about your filing system. They work on disk block level. The filing system works on file and directory level. And the operating system just passes it on. So I don't know what this is. Delete, I don't unlink. I forget. Unlink takes a file descriptor or a file name? I think it's a file name. So this is a little Unix usage. To create a file, you must use the create file system call and give it a name. You can give it a full qualified path name or a local file name and create that file. There is a call which I forget which creates directories, but this is for creating files. And there are two different system calls for creating files and for creating directories. This will create an empty file. Put its name in the directory table so that you can get to it. And unlink will delete a path to a file. And if that's the last path to a file, your file will be gone forever. Okay. There is no undo to unlink. Which unlink is the system call. The command command RM that you might have used, remove, is a program that uses the unlink call to delete the file. So RM is the name of the application program which has an unlink system call embedded in it which will delete the file. Now, open is kind of a strange thing. In order to work with files, you have to use the open system call first. What does it do? Well, it does nothing really. It does, but it's like, it is not clear what does open do, but programmers are told you will use open. Otherwise, you cannot touch a file. So the demystification is as follows. How would you touch a file? You can read or write the file. How would you structure a read system call? Read file name, right? Or write file name. Now you're doing hundreds and thousands of accesses to a file. Read, 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 little bits, more, etc. Every time you give the operating system a file name, it has to go hunt for the I number. So it's much better that you use the I number and not the file name. So that's why it will be very much slower if you use file names to read-write files. Files, ID is I number. So it's best to have the I number and use the I number in read-write. But for some reason, instead of I numbers, there's another number called a file descriptor that's used. So the open system call finds the file, flags if it doesn't exist, and checks whether you have permission to the file and gives you an I number. And then you use the I number for all other purposes. But that's a little bit of a lie. But open will use... Okay, I'm still... There's something called a file table. It's a per-process private table in Unix Linux. And open will find the file. There's a kernel routine called nameI, which takes a name, converts it to an I number. nameI will work correctly if the file exists. If the file doesn't exist, nameI will return an error. After nameI returns the I number, the open system call will check whether the permissions are right. Like you said, write, can I write to that file? Is the ownership okay? If everything is okay, it takes the I number and puts it in a table and returns the index of the table to the user level. And that index to the table is called FD or file descriptor. And I wrote down returns 3 because that's what it does the first time you use it. FD0 is standard input, FD1 is standard output, FD2 is standard error. These three are opened before you even run the program. So FD3 is available. If you open a file, you'll get the number 3. And if you open another file, you'll get the number 4. And these are entries where your I number is located. Okay. So once you open a file and get a file descriptor, the read system call takes an FD. You must have opened this file, or you can use 0, 1, or 2. 0 or 1. No, 0. 1 is output, so it shouldn't be used for read. You put in a file descriptor. You give a pointer to an array where the incoming data will be stored. You're trying to read something. Where are you going to put it? Here's a buffer, an array, a struct, or whatever, where the incoming data will go. And a number of how many bytes to read. Read will read any number of bytes you tell me how many you want. How do I know how many I want? Well, that's your problem, not mine. So you kind of make a guess of how many bytes you want on this shot, and you tell it to read that many bytes. And this number of bytes must be less than the buffer, otherwise you'll have a buffer overflow. There'll be no check. If you give it an array of 100 bytes and ask for 500 bytes of data, it's going to overwrite all kinds of things. Okay? Because this is the operating system. It has powers to overwrite anything. It doesn't know what your data structures are. It's going to overwrite it. After this terminates, you will get a value n. N is the number of bytes actually read. If it's a file, you will probably get the same number that you asked for if the file is big enough. If you reach the end of the file, that N will be less than this N. And if you try to read again, that N will be zero. And if you're reading from a keyboard, that N will be the number of characters typed by the user, irrelevant of what is the other N you put in. Unless if the number of characters typed by the user is more than the N you wanted. And that's where the programming difficulty comes. How many characters should I read? How many will he type? What happens if I give it a little less and then... Okay? That you've got to figure out by trial and error. And the write system call is exactly the opposite. And the write system call just takes whatever is contained in that buffer or array and dumps it out into the file. No translations. If it got garbage bytes in it, it'll go out as bytes. Printf or any of those things actually translate, does conversions. If you give it an integer, it'll look at the integer bits and convert it to a decimal form and then convert it to an ASCII form and then print it out. This one will just dump. So these are low-level system calls. So, boils down to, this is a file. You have a file stored on disk, it has a certain size. I'll talk about size in a minute. It has a certain size. It is named through a directory. The last directory which is pointing to this has the I number of this file. If some process is using the file, the same I number will be in the process table. The entry number is X, which is the file descriptor that the process is using to access the file. So this is a much quicker way of accessing the file than using the name of the file where you'll have to go through all the directories to find the file. And the size of the file, also there is something called a file pointer. The file pointer is also per process. And it is part of this file table also. The file pointer is this part of the file has been read. Has been read or has been written? There's a little bit of a difference. Let's go with has been read. That means if you want to read, you issue a read system call, this part of the file will be read. For write, it's a little bit different. And if you keep on reading the file, the last chunk will return less number of bytes. Any further, when the file pointer is at the end, any attempt to read the file will give you 0 bytes. 0 bytes return means you have reached the end of the file. Contrary to popular belief, there is no end of file character in any file. That's a myth. Okay. So the end of file is not indicated by a special character, but it's indicated by the size of the file that's stored in the inode and the value of the file pointer. File pointer equals size of file is the end of file condition. And that's pretty much it as far as files go. Yes, there is plenty more. There is a whole bunch of rules and semantics. I'm just giving you a quick overview, not teaching you how to program with files. That's a whole different class. Now, writing files, there are many modes. You can actually position a file pointer here and overwrite a piece of the file. Not advisable, but it's doable. Some complex applications do it. Typically, you start with an empty file, and the file pointer is always at the end of the file, and as you write more, the file size expands, and the inodes get filled up more. And that's all done by the file system. Okay, where are we on time? Oh, we're out of time. So, the next class I'm going to talk about some more data about recovery and consistency of file systems, and maybe some little bit of file semantics, and then we'll talk about privileges, escalation, user control, access control, some leftover topics. And that'll be the end of it. And that's Thursday's class. Next Tuesday's class, bring questions. I'm going to only answer questions in class, not present new material. Okay?